Are vegans actually unhealthy?
Does cannabis ruin your sleep?
And why are so many men taking testosterone supplements? I'm Mitch.
And I'm Greg.
And we're the creators of the popular YouTube channel ASAP Science.
Every week on our podcast Side Note by ASAP Science, we explain the science behind a controversial subject with recent research, up-to-date studies, and ridiculous stories so you are entertained while, bam, simultaneously learning.
We're here to make science make sense.
Download Side Note by ASAP Science wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to a Frequency Podcast Network production in association with City News. This is a story about an international drug syndicate. If it is not the biggest one in the entire world, it is near the top of the list. Police have estimated its revenue at about $21 billion a year. For comparison, you may have heard of El Chapo. His cartel at its peak was about $3 billion. So why is a Canadian news podcast telling you this story? It's because of the man who is allegedly at the center of this syndicate. His name is Seyshi Lop, and he has Canadian citizenship. Not only does he have Canadian citizenship, he has deep roots in Canada's largest city. In fact, Toronto was where he began his suspected career and developed the style that would eventually allow an empire to flourish in Asia and around the world. So who is Seyshi Lop? How did he, allegedly, do it? Who were the big circle boys, and what was it about Toronto and Canada in the late 80s and 90s that gave birth to a global empire? I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. This is The Big Story. Stephen Marsh is a writer, reporter, and author. He dug into the story of Seyshi Lop for Toronto Life. Hey, Stephen.
Hey, how are you?
I'm doing well. Why don't we just start with the obvious question? Who is Seyshi Lop?
Well, he's the architect, or the alleged architect, of the largest meth syndicate in history out of China, which was responsible for somewhere around 60% of the meth trade in all of Asia. And he was recently caught by a group of about 20 different agencies that had to get together to catch him. And he was back on his way to Toronto when they caught him in Amsterdam's airport. So he was the largest meth kingpin by orders of magnitude. You know, the profits were about as large as Citibank's. And then, of course, before then, he also ran the most successful heroin distribution network in history out of Toronto in the 1990s. So he's an unusual man in that he's actually run two of the largest drugs networks in history and on different continents and in different decades.
Tell me about his beginnings, at least, in Toronto. What's his connection to the city and how did he get started here in Canada?
Well, he was one of the wave of immigrants from Hong Kong who came here before the repatriation of Hong Kong. He was part of the Big Circle Boys even then. So they're a gang would be the wrong word. Criminal organization would, I guess, loosely fit what they are. They're not organized crime, but they are criminals and they are organized, if you know what I mean. They came to Toronto in the 80s and they were apex thieves in Hong Kong. They were running, you know, enormous thefts out of banks and out of jewelry stores in Hong Kong. But when they came to Toronto, they really kind of had to start over because they didn't really understand the networks here. And they began as pickpockets and then they moved on to large scale credit card fraud, as well as money laundering. And they even did, you know, TTC tokens, and they created whole new businesses. And then eventually they turned to drugs because that's where the big money is.
What was Toronto like at that time in terms of organized crime? What was happening? You spoke to people who were deeply involved in trying to stop it at the time.
Well, I mean, yeah, there's a lot of violence. They called it terror in the streets. There was a big illegal scene in all of the Chinatowns in Toronto run out of the illegal gambling houses. And from that, there were essentially a series of criminal gangs who were violently trying to take over the businesses to extort them for really tiny sums of cash. And that led to quite a lot of violence. Now, the Big Circle Boys that Say Chilo comes out of have nothing to do with any of that. They do not do violence. They do violence, but when a business becomes violent, they just leave it. Hmm. They tend to start markets rather than try to impinge on other people's markets. They truly outcompete by price rather than by violence. So they don't have, you know, the terminologists call it like violent monopolies on trade. They're not interested in that. They're interested in getting into businesses where they can make huge amounts of money by being competitive and outcompeting their opponents.
Tell me a little bit more about how Say rose to the head of this. Yeah, I won't call it a gang. The head of this organized group of criminals.
Well, there is no head. Like, he has no say over anyone. They're not like a mafia or a triad,
right,
or anything like it, or certainly not like a biker gang, because they don't have hierarchies. And you can use their name. Like, if you want to go call yourself a Big Circle Boy on the streets today, go ahead. They don't care. Hmm. Which is, unlike any other organized criminal gang, you know, with biker gangs where they have like actual patches that identify them. Like, these guys don't want to be identified at all.
Right.
They prefer to be completely hidden from everyone.
A loose coalition.
Colleagues. I mean, that's what they okay. are. They're like illegal colleagues. And he became the biggest one because he was the best at it. It'd be like sort of like saying, like, how did a guy become the president of TD Bank? Like, he became the president of TD Bank because he had the most connections, because he knew how things worked best, because his other colleagues really wanted to work with him, and because he, you know, he built businesses, right? So he's not the head of a gang in the sense of there was some bloody war and he became right. the leader or something like that. He's just the best at it.
So what was his life like then, from a practical point of view, when he was kind of at the peak of his powers, for lack of a better term, in Toronto?
Well, in Toronto, he probably was only a leading figure for a brief while. I mean, he was responsible for organizing, you know, the great heroin network shipment called China White, which was 90% of the heroin in New York and 50% of the heroin in the United States. He brought it from the Golden Triangle, from warlords in the Golden Triangle in Thailand and Laos. He shipped it into Vancouver, to Toronto and Montreal. And then from Montreal, he piggybacked essentially on the Rizzuto family's cocaine shipping network, which they had with the Colombian cartels. And this was sort of a magnificent innovation in some ways, because, you know, it was the opposite of traditional organized crime. It was inter-ethnic cooperation. The Rizzutos were famous as well for being quite collegial. Like, they were not famous for violence. They were famous for bringing people together and working with large numbers of groups of different criminal organizations. So there was a kind of more openness there. And they built this heroin shipment network that was, you know, the most important heroin shipment network in the world.
Do we have any idea of his personal wealth, status, family, anything at that time? Like, what he was like, what his actual life was?
Well, I mean, he was living in a lap of luxury. I mean, that's what this is all about. Huge meals and, you know, visiting celebrities and the shows and like the whole deal. I mean, he definitely had a wife and kids, and his in-laws and his parents were in Toronto and they were all living together. But these are, the Big Circle Boys are not flashy. Like, I mean, an FBI agent said to me once, like, you know, the thing about most drug dealers is that they actually want the world to know that they're drug dealers. Mm-hmm. And that makes them really easy to catch and really easy to spot. Whereas when you have people who really are polite and do not engage in any of that nonsense and don't belong to any kind of like hierarchies and so on, it's much harder to even spot them. So he would have had a luxurious but quite ordinary life, really. You know, I mean, he was a gambler. He once lost 60 million euros one night in Macau. And then he was traveling with a team of 8 Thai bodyguards and flying private jets everywhere. But, you know, by then he had a business worth $21 billion a year. So that comes with certain realities. All of that is alleged, of course.
Right, of course. So what eventually brought his business in Toronto and across North America down? I gathered there was a collaborative investigation. Can you tell me about what happened there and how it worked or didn't work?
Well, it was a guy named Mark Callinan at the FBI and a cop called Mario Lamothe from Montreal, who everyone told me is in the Hall of Fame of cops. He's like one of these unbelievable undercover cops, you know, and they essentially worked their way up from the street corners in New York to where does it come from? It's all coming from Toronto. Where does it come from, Toronto? Well, it all comes from this one guy. They'd caught a lot of the Big Circle boys by then anyway, but they knew he was in Hong Kong, and then they had to use the Hong Kong police to catch him. So that was a collaborative effort of 4 or 5 police departments, like the RCMP, the FBI, Toronto Police, Montreal Police, Hong Kong Royal Police. They worked together to get him. And they did. And he did 9 years at Elkton, where he made a wealth of connections and then prepared for the sort of next phase of his criminal life.
I'm Laura Palmer, host of Island Crime. Season 6, Sweethearts, is the story of 3 teenage girls who were all murdered in Victoria, Canada, within about 12 months.
So she was scared. Something out there scared her.
You've just created the playground where predators can really thrive.
She was a 16-year-old girl. She was a sweetheart.
Listen to Sweethearts at frequencypodcastnetwork.com or wherever you get podcasts.
Find your frequency.
And so he was released in 2006, and then, I guess, allegedly, as we're talking about here, immediately just decides, that's it, I've had it with drugs, I'm going to walk the straight and narrow forevermore.
Yes, that's it, and that's the end of the story. No, he came back to Toronto, and Toronto was too small for him then. The Rizzutos were involved in an extremely bloody vendetta that really consumed almost all of their attention. And, you know, the Big Circle boys, and certainly Titchy Lep, are not interested in violent businesses or anything like that. Like, they're interested in large scales of money. That is what drives them. So the large money was very obviously in meth and mm-hmm. very obviously in Asia, which was growing, you know, explosively. He figured out how to dominate the Asian meth trade in a highly innovative way that, you know, totally upended the business and essentially made him the supplier for, like, he was almost all the supply in Australia, but he was also most of the supply in Japan, the Philippines, Korea, Taiwan, Vietnam, Thailand. Like, he really controlled this almost immediately, which is a huge feat considering who you've got to deal with in these places. Mm-hmm. Like, to be able to make deals with the Yakuza and Australian biker gangs for the same product in the same lifetime is, you know, astonishing.
This is Sam Gore that we're talking about, right?
Yeah, Sam Gore. Well, Sam Gore is just none of these names are the names they give themselves.
Okay.
They're not a mafia. They don't, mm-hmm. as I said, they don't define themselves that way. Like, it would be a mistake to call them organized crime. Like, a triad is like organized crime. They swear oaths to each other. They, you know, none of that applies. These are just businessmen, right? Who just deal in high levels of narcotics, right? High weight of narcotics.
So what was so unique about this particular narcotics business?
Well, what he figured out that the cost of making meth is essentially negligible. You know, when you watch Breaking Bad and you see all this stuff about quality and stuff like that, it's all nonsense. That they do that for drama. Like, you actually don't need hugely pure meth to be just as effective on the marketplace. You need a reliable product. Also, getting the material in the Golden Triangle, which is essentially a stateless place, is extremely easy and almost free. Some of the products that you need to make this are as low as a couple $1,000s a ton, like red phosphorus and so on. And the other thing is, like, it takes, you know, 1,000 farmers to make a ton of heroin. It takes 10 guys in a lab to make a ton of meth. So the first thing he did was get the product cost so low that he could essentially guarantee delivery. Not essentially, like, he did. He guaranteed delivery. So he allegedly went to all these different gangs and said, like, look, you can make your own meth in Australia or the Philippines or whatever, or you could order from me. I'll deliver it to you at a reasonable price. And if it doesn't arrive, I will replace it at no cost. You take none of the risk. I will take all of the risk. And basically, no one could say no.
Right.
In a sense, he's getting power over them. But on the other hand, like, what he's offering them is so sweet. It's not possible to compete because his product is reliable, fully works. And, you know, you want to bring materials into Australia, go through the very risky business of making them and then compete with his product. I mean, it wouldn't make any sense to do that. And so that's how he got a business that's scaled up to $21 billion a year.
Satisfaction guaranteed or your money back is a pretty tempting proposition for any illegal activity.
It's just too comfortable a deal. It's too convenient to say no to.
So you briefly mentioned $21 billion, which is the next thing I was going to ask you. Just at its peak, what kind of scale are we talking about here? What was it worth? And honestly, like, how do you hide that amount of drugs being shipped anywhere?
Well, hiding the drugs is not really a problem. Like, you know, for example, the entire supply of illegal heroin into Canada for a given year would fit in the trunk of a car. Huh. Smuggling the drugs is not really the problem. So you just use mules who are completely disposable and they take the risk and you're fine. But the money is a problem. $21 billion in cash is a logistical nightmare.
Mm-hmm.
And how you transport it and how you turn it into something that you can use is a whole other set of problems. I mean, one of the things was that there was an economic zone in Laos with a casino in it that was owned by an alleged criminal kingpin from China that was a money laundering factory, essentially. But he also used Australian casinos and the junket operators, which are rather quite technical financial implements used to get high rollers to gamble when gambling is illegal in China. And he used that system masterfully. I mean, it's bringing down a lot of people in Australia right now because Australia has a grotesque meth epidemic of like proportions I don't think we can really imagine. 7% of the population have tried it. Compare that to 0.4% of the population in America. But, you know, just to put the money in perspective, like El Chapo at his peak, his cartel had annual profits of about $3 billion a year.
Okay.
So you're dealing with seven times the size of the largest drug kingpin in Mexican history.
And all of this money was cleaned basically through casinos.
Casinos were a major way. I mean, they had a million different ways. Like if you're dealing with $21 billion,
right,
like you're using real estate. I mean, Toronto real estate, Canadian real estate is a huge money laundering problem. Mm-hmm. Art was another way, and you know, other dark markets.
So what eventually, because you mentioned at the beginning that, you know, he's currently been caught again. What brought this one down?
My impression from talking with the police is that essentially if the police know who you are, they will catch you. And in a sense, the Big Circle boys know this. Like, they've been known to congratulate the police who catch them. I mean, they know the risks that they're running.
Right.
It took 20 agencies to bring him down because he was in Taiwan and probably had political protection of some kind that no one's really describing. They put him on Interpol and they had to make it impossible for him to move and then force him to move. And then they caught him.
And what's he facing charges on? And what's the status of his case? And what are the chances he goes away for good this time?
I mean, he's in Amsterdam. He's going to take his case in Holland to the Supreme Court. So that will be a separate matter. I think it's for a 2013 case that they kind of have him dead to rights on, or they feel they do.
What's happened to, and I'm not going to use the term syndicates or organizations, but what's happened to these drug smuggling businesses since his departure from them, first in Toronto and now in China?
Oh, nothing. I mean, these networks are supply and demand. Like they're just economic realities. Like, you know, I remember talking to one undercover cop who was undercover in great deal of danger for 4 or 5 years in England, like really risking his life every day. And they broke everything up. They totally disrupted the criminal network they were intended to catch. They caught everybody. They won. And the supply of drugs stopped for half a day. It took half a day for the drug markets to resume to their original status. And the other thing is, like, when you have new drug markets, they become violent at first before they stabilize. So it just led to increases in violence, and it didn't affect the supply of drugs at all. No, I mean, the war on drugs is totally ineffective. It doesn't make any difference at all. Like, what makes a difference is either the government taking over these markets or active efforts to decrease demand.
I mean, that was going to be my last question, is it seems like this entire story, both here and overseas, makes the case for legalization of drugs because there's simply no way to stop it otherwise.
Well, I don't think legalized. I mean, we're not talking about marijuana here. We're talking about methamphetamine. It's poison, right? And like heroin, these are poisons. And they have huge, huge social effects. But I think, you know, decriminalization and then working towards limiting demand. I mean, the police chief here is in favor of that in Toronto. He's actively in favor of it.
Yes.
It's worked other places. You know, all these cops that I talked to who were extremely gutsy, like extremely courageous people who were fighting for their societies in profoundly dangerous conditions. Like, it seems to me absurd to send them into these dangerous positions when we're very unclear if it has any effect whatsoever on what we're trying to stop. So everyone that I've talked to who knows what they're talking about, i.e. cops, i.e. people at the UN who deal with large scale trade, they're all in favor of decriminalization. So I don't really have an opinion of my own that's worth something, but that's certainly their opinion.
Stephen, thank you so much for this. It's a fascinating story.
Pleasure.
Stephen Marsh, writing in Toronto Life. That was The Big Story. For more from us, head to thebigstorypodcast.ca. Find us on Twitter at TheBigStoryFPN. Talk to us anytime, as you know, via email, TheBigStoryPodcast, that's all one word, at rci.rogers.com. Thank you for your story ideas over the past week. Please keep them coming. We have more than we know what to do with, which is great. Unfortunately, global events keep preventing us from covering some of the more fascinating little stories from around the country, and we will make an effort to get to those in the coming weeks. It can't always be the end of the world. Surely. You can find this podcast in every podcast player, and of course, you can ask your smart speaker to play The Big Story Podcast. Thanks for listening. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. We'll talk tomorrow.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.